There's a high fly ball.
Welcome back to the Meyer Jensen Sports Open Line.
And it's a gunner.
Big fly, Nolan Arenado.
Meyer Jensen, a personal injury law firm, because sometimes the gloves have to come off. MeyerJensen.com.
And the Billikens win this one.
Touchdown, Kansas City.
On America's Sports Voice, KMOX.
All right, good to be with you in the 7 o'clock hour on Sports Open Line. I promised, and I'm going to deliver on this promise, to talk some real baseball here today. And this first part of the conversation is going to lead to the second part. So follow along. You'll see where I'm going here. But today, I was planning on talking about on-field baseball. I've been trying to find something to talk about, things that I really think would be interesting. And well, earlier today, I had to change. I was going to talk pitching today, and I decided to change it because I saw a tweet, and I'm not trying to pick on the dude that tweeted it. I don't know him. He works for CBS Sports. I'm definitely not picking on the guy, but he writes for CBS Sports. His name is Danny Vietti, and he had a tweet about Nolan Arenado, and I'm not sure what prompted it because I wasn't following along with a conversation or anything before that, but there's no other thread before that that explains it. But I saw it, and I thought, I think there's more to this story. So I quote-tweeted it, and I threw the more to the story in there. So here's what the tweet was. And again, it wasn't a rip of Nolan Arenado in any way. It was just an observation. So this was the tweet from Danny Vietti from CBS Sports. And it was Nolan Arenado in 2021. 255 batting average, lowest of his career. 0.9 defensive war, lowest of his career. 6.7% barrel percentage, lowest of his career. 37.1 hard hit rate, lowest of his career. 807 OPS, lowest since 2013. 34 home runs, fewest since 2014. Weighted runs created plus 113, lowest since 2014. So, in other words, what you're saying there is Nolan Arenado was not as good a player when he got out of Colorado. That's the message there, right? And my reply to that via quote tweet was, here's Nolan Arenado's numbers on the road in 2021, and you'll see where I'm going with this as I go. So Nolan Arenado on the road this year hit .279. His career batting average is .288. His slugging percentage on the road this year was .549. His career slug, including games at Coors Field, .535. His OPS plus this year was .119. For his career, it's .121. On the road, Nolan Arenado hit 20 home runs in 80 games this season. That's a 40 home run pace. So you see how that contrasts with the stats that the CBS Sports guy put out there? So what does that mean? And by the way, I should also point out, since Danny Vietti put in some defensive stuff too, and some hard hit rate stuff, Nolan Arenado was also 96th percentile in Major League Baseball in outs above average, according to StatCast. The problem with defense and grading it is that there are a lot of different ways to look at it. So, you know, you got to pick and choose which ones look good or bad. You can find them, but I mean, 96th percentile is pretty good, right? Top 4%. Is that good? And also this year, his average exit velocity was 89. His career average exit velo is 89.4. Okay, so just I wanted to throw all that in there. So what does all of that mean? Well, it means that it sucks to be a right-handed hitter at Busch Stadium. That's what it means. So for as much as we fully understand, comprehend, and talk about the Coors Field effect for offensive numbers, right? Your offensive numbers are typically very good there. The ball carries because of the altitude. It's a big field, so the outfielders are spread out more. The gaps are bigger. There's more surface area to cover in that outfield. And at that altitude, pitches don't move as much as they do at sea level. Your sinker sinks less. Your curveball curves less. Your slider slides less. Your changeup drops less. Everything moves less at the altitude because there's less air resistance. So we fully accept and understand that, right? I mean, who argues that? Nobody. Well, then why don't we fully grasp and understand and talk about the exact opposite effect, which is what it's like at Busch Stadium right now? Busch Stadium suppresses offense. It absolutely does. The team is studying it, trying to figure out why exactly. I mean, I think we all, you know, in my conversations about this with Derek Gould, and other people, but Derek and I specifically talked about this on his podcast. It really, there's a direct line in the sand. When the second phase of Ballpark Village was finished, this problem became greater. But you know what? It started before that. So keep in mind that when I was at KMOX the first stretch, so this was around 2012, 2013, because 2013 was my last season covering the Cardinals for KMOX before I switched, and now obviously I'm back. So this was 2013. I had this conversation, not alone, by the way. It was in a group conversation with Mike Matheny in the dugout, talking about why it seemed like offense for both the home team and the visiting team was down at Busch Stadium compared to what it had been. Seemed like there were fewer homers. Balls weren't carrying as much. And I asked Mike Matheny, I asked him about it, like, why? You know, it's not just you guys, it's the opponents too. Any ideas on why? And obviously it was, you know, Ballpark Village was being built. There's construction down there. And it just changes wind flow, right? Or airflow, maybe not wind flow. Maybe it changes, it's changed. I don't know that we've pinpointed why, but I don't think it's a coincidence that ever since all of that stuff went up, it's become harder to hit home runs at Busch Stadium, and particularly for right-handed hitters. And if you want an illustration of what this looks like, that's what we're going to get into next. Because when you look at the Cardinals' offense at home and then look at it on the road, it's almost like two different teams. So I want to get into that, be a little bit more specific about how that breaks down. And I also want to talk about how we maybe need to adjust how we look at the numbers so we fully understand, right? Because my argument is never going to be that we should lower our expectations for the St. Louis Cardinals. That's not the point. But we do need to understand how to break it down. I'm going to talk a bit about that next up on KMOX.
Your home of the Cardinals, Billikens, yes. And Chiefs.
Touchdown, Kansas City!
America's Sports Voice, KMOX.
All right, talking on-field baseball. I love doing this part. And again, this is all about us having the right context to make evaluations about what we're seeing, right? I mean, I think it's important. That's why I started with that Nolan Arenado tweet, and the tweet from before, and my answer to it, which, again, was, well, yeah, I mean, it's hard to hit at Busch Stadium. And if you look at Arenado's numbers on the road, they look like his numbers at Coors, like when he was still splitting time between the road and Coors Field. The only reason that some of them were down is because it's hard to hit at Busch Stadium, which is something that a lot of hitters find out about as they go. And if you look at the Cardinals team last year, no matter how you want to break it down, if you're looking at kind of broad ways to look at statistics, right? If you're looking at, you know, big picture numbers as opposed to small ones, if you're looking at things like runs scored, that's an important number. OPS is an important number. Batting average, it's one thing, but it's not that big a thing. It's only important in that it's a part of OPS. But when you look at their home and road splits, it tells you a pretty big story. So at home in 2021, the Cardinals had the 27th best offense in baseball in OPS. Does that sound good? No, it's not. Now, again, their team is built to play defense and to pitch. And this is why when I evaluate 2021, I think the biggest failing of the team was the pitching staff not living up to expectations. And, of course, that was in part because of injury and part because some people that you needed to perform well did not perform well at all. In fact, they weren't just not good, they were bad. I think that was the biggest flaw in the team. So when you but when you look at the offense, right? And here's part of the problem too. Is, you know, fans are coming out to watch the team in person at the home ballpark. Well, I just pointed out that they have the 27th best OPS in baseball playing at home, and in terms of just runs scored, they were 29th in Major League Baseball in home games. The only team that scored fewer runs at home this year was the New York Mets. So you're 29th when you're playing at home. So what did it look like on the road? Well, I'm glad you asked me that because I happen to know. And it's a pretty stunning difference, too. You know, when you look at the road offense this year, starting with the simple runs scored, remember that whole 29th out of 30? Yeah, on the road this year, 7th in Major League Baseball. Not in the National League. In Major League Baseball, 7th. The only teams that scored... No, actually, sorry, my bad. Tied for 6th. The only teams that scored more runs in their home ballparks in 2021 were Tampa Bay, Houston, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and Oakland. You tied with Toronto for the 6th most runs scored in Major League Baseball playing at your home ballpark. And then if you want to go a little further and look at OPS instead of just runs scored, you see the same thing. I mean, it really is remarkable how much of a difference it is, and it's night and day. Because, you know, I mentioned that OPS was 27th at home. Yeah, on the road, it is 5th in Major League Baseball. Again, not in the National League. In Major League Baseball, the 5th best OPS. The only teams that had a better team OPS than the Cardinals playing in road games were Houston, Toronto, San Francisco, and Tampa Bay. So what does that tell us? Well, I mean, number one, it tells us that it's hard to put up numbers at Busch Stadium. And harder than it used to be, which is the part that they're studying. And, you know, that's the part that we're trying to figure out. I think we all seem to understand that it's related to the construction downtown and Ballpark Village and all that. Now, this doesn't mean anything, by the way, for wins and losses. You understand that, right? I mean, like, the other teams have the same problem you do. It's hard for them to hit at Busch Stadium, too. So there's no advantage. There's no disadvantage. Except that, you know, you play 81 games there and the other teams that are coming into town don't play more than, you know, like the Central Division teams come in, they don't play more than 19 games. Actually, not 19, they play 9 or 10. So in that sense, it's a little bit of a disadvantage. But really, it's not. It shouldn't impact wins or losses. You know, as you see, on when they go out on the road, they were a top 5 or 6 offense in Major League Baseball last year. At home, they were the bottom 3 or 4. But not that far out of alignment with what other teams were doing at Busch Stadium, too. And you know how we can figure that out? Not really all that hard. Just look at your home record. Right? I mean, Cardinals did not have problems winning games at home last year. They were 45-36. And by the way, what's interesting is they had the same record on the road. They were 45-36, both at home and on the road. Exactly the same record. So clearly, the home-road split isn't something that's costing them in the standings. So the reason I'm pointing that out is it doesn't mean that we shouldn't expect more wins. You know, they won 90 games last year. The expectation this year should be more. We should be looking at the 94-95 range. And there's no reason why they shouldn't be able to get to that point. Because they have added another starting pitcher that'll bring stability. And I think they can more reasonably expect a healthier season too from Jack Flaherty, Dakota Hudson, and Miles Mikolas. It's not a guarantee. There's nothing ever guaranteed with a player's health, and in particular a pitcher's health. But I do think it's reasonable to expect a healthier year from all three. It's not a really high standard, is it? I mean, Flaherty missed half the year. Hudson didn't arrive until late September. And obviously, Mikolas only pitched, 25-30% of the season? So expecting more than that is not really a high expectation. So they should be better if you just have more games from those guys. And then you throw in Steven Matz, who's a stable veteran starter. You should be better there by itself. Now, that's not to say that they're done. They definitely need another arm, maybe two for the bullpen. But the expectation should be what the Brewers were last year. We should be shooting as fans. Our expectation level should be 94, 95 wins this year. Especially since we know so much more about the everyday lineup. I mean, we look at those stats, those splits that I told you. You're a good producing team on the road. And that means relative to your competition, you're perfectly competitive at home. But you know who your left fielder is now. You know who your center fielder is. You know who your right fielder is. And I do think it's fair to kind of count on a little bit more offense from Dylan Carlson in particular. I would say that, you know, it's going to be tough to count on more from Tyler O'Neill. If he can even give you close to what you got from him last year, that would be pretty fantastic. I mean, that would be really fantastic. But I think you know more about what's going on there. I mean, you know what you have at first and third base. And then what you have in the middle infield is still a bit of an uncertainty, right? We don't know exactly how a shortstop's going to play out. But you know that you have options. We don't know exactly how second base is going to play out. Because even though Tommy Edman won a gold glove and he played every day last year and he's capable of playing every day, I mean, Nolan Gorman's the kind of talent that when he's ready and knocking on the door, he'll just knock that door right off its frame. Like, guys that can play second base and hit 30 home runs are pretty rare, and he's got both of those capabilities. And then we have other prospects that don't come with the profile that Nolan Gorman does, but they come with the come with the same proximity to the major leagues. I mean, Juan Yepes doesn't have a whole lot left to prove in the minor leagues. He had 27 home runs last year. Most of that was at AAA, and then in the Arizona Fall League was the second best hitter there amongst all of the best hitting prospects in the game. So he's a guy that is going to be counted on this year in some way. He's of the right age, he's on the 40-man roster, and he's coming off a big year. You know, we talked about him right near the end of the year. I think it might have been during the postseason. It might have been right before the wild card game. But anyway, he's a guy that the team is very happy about in terms of growth, in terms of progress. Brendan Donovan's another one. You know, he's a guy that's not been he's never been a highly ranked prospect, but he put up big numbers in the minor leagues. He had a great Arizona Fall League. He plays all over the infield. And he's a guy that could hit his way into the mix too. So you throw those guys in with Nolan Gorman. I mean, the offense can and should be even better this year than it was last year. And I'll tell you, if you want a really good look at that, a really detailed breakdown, Bernie Miklas wrote about that today at scoopswithdannymac.com. He looked ahead to 2022 in the offense. And, I mean, it really is a great in-depth look at why the offense will probably be better next year than it was in 2021. But you're still going to have that same dynamic of the Hoban Road split. They're not going to solve that problem during the offseason. They're not going to say right now, hey, let's move in the fences, because that takes a lot of time. It's too late for any of that for next year. And I'm not sure they want to do that anyway. But, you know, I think when we evaluate, and by the way, we got to keep this in mind too. This also impacts how we evaluate pitchers. You know, great numbers at Busch Stadium are going to be a little easier to come by. It's going to be a little tougher on the road. And that's something that we have to keep in mind as well, that as we're evaluating the team, how does it look home versus away? So when we look at, you know, the Cardinals pitching staff, for an example, and how does that home-road split play for them? Because I think that's an important thing to kind of keep in mind. Like, you know, I think you have the kind of pitching staff that will work either at home or on the road. There shouldn't be a huge difference because of the defense. And that's, You know, it's funny that for so long we've talked about defense and, you know, what that means to a team and how important it is to emphasize that. It's the one thing that really shouldn't change very much, home or away. If you're a good defensive team, that'll play in any ballpark. In fact, having the kind of outfield that they do should give you some kind of an advantage when you get on the road and play in a bigger outfield like Coors Field. And obviously it gives you one here. So if you look at the Cardinals pitching staff as an example, at home, they were sixth in baseball in runs allowed, sixth best. So obviously that means fewest on the pitching side of things. And when you look at it on the road, certainly, you know, we understand that every team's road schedule is different, right? I mean, the Cardinals play more games in Milwaukee and Chicago and Cincinnati, right? Those are good hitters' ballparks, and they're all in your division. So that can impact that. On the road, when it comes to runs allowed this past season, I believe they were, I'm trying to remember the exact spot that they fell in the standings, but they were in the bottom half of baseball. Actually, they were right in the middle. So they gave up the 19th most runs on the road, which, by the way, is a pretty good thing, right? When we can see how much easier it is to hit away from Busch Stadium, and you can see that your offense is still kind of in the middle of the pack, your pitching staff is still in the middle of the pack when it comes to the runs that they allow. What do you think the reason is? Well, it's the defense. Defense travels. So what all of this means to me, in the simplest of terms, is we should expect this team to win 4, 5, 6 more games this coming year. With one major caveat, reasonably good health. You always have to throw that into the mix because, you know, you lose Goldschmidt for 3 months or something dramatic like that, that's going to change how the dynamic looks. But what we learned from 2021 is a couple of really smart, really interesting things. And obviously one is you're a top 5 or 6 offense on the road. You're a bottom 3 or 4 offense at home. But again, your opponents get both of those boosts. So the pitching staff is that we have to look at that at the same time. We see the pitching staff at home, one of the best in Major League Baseball. On the road, middle of the pack, which stresses how important this team's defensive construct is, why it matters so much that they're an elite defensive team. It's the only way you can explain those two things. Because pitching is impacted by the defense. Offense is impacted by offense. It is impacted by the other team's defense. But, you know, normally, again, defense is not much different playing at Busch than it is at Wrigley Field, for example. The infield dimensions are the same. The outfield is different, but being able to cover more ground like the Cardinals outfielders can is an even bigger asset in a bigger ballpark, and it's the same. You get the same benefit in a smaller one because you still get to things that other guys don't. So I guess the simple version to close that out is expect more in 2022. I think you have a lot of things aligning, plus the opportunity when the lockout ends to add another piece to the pen and maybe a left-handed bat for the bench or something. You've got really good prospects that are very close to the major leagues. You got some pitchers that are close too. There's really no reason to think that this team won't be significantly better. Last week, I made my prediction already. I went crazy on the Charlie Brennan show because I was making 2022 predictions, not just for sports, but for a bunch of things. And I'm going to go with it still. Cardinals win the division this year, and they're going to win 95 games or more. And when I'm wrong, I'll be here to laugh at myself. All right, hang tight. We're going to actually talk a little football next on KMOX.
There's a high fly ball.
Welcome back to the Meyer Jensen Sports Open Line.
And it's a gutter.
Big fly, Nolan Arenado.
Meyer Jensen, a personal injury law firm, because sometimes the gloves have to come off. MeyerJensen.com.
And the Billikens win this one.
Touchdown, Kansas City.
On America's Sports Voice, KMOX.
Well, we got a first now. We are now in the first ever week 18 of the NFL season. First ever Week 18, obviously the first ever 17-game season for the National Football League. And I guess you could say that it's been pretty interesting. I still don't know how well I can sort through all of this as far as what to expect in the postseason. When you look at the AFC, I mean, who really stands out? Buffalo, New England, Cincinnati, Tennessee, and Kansas City. Those are the top five teams, and they're all within one game of each other. They're all between 10-6 and 11-5, and the Chiefs are 11-5. You know, they're sitting there with all of the world in front of them. But how many of those teams do you look at and say, oh, yeah, they're going to make the run? Now, Derrick Henry is back at practice this week. I don't know if it means he's going to be activated. I don't know what it means for the postseason, but, you know, that team with Derrick Henry is a lot different team than without. We know what the Chiefs are capable of, but we also know that they've been kind of up and down this year. It's not nearly what I expected. I thought they were going to be a lot better team than this. I thought they were going to be more consistent. 11-5, I guess they could be 12-5 with a win this week. I expected more like 13-14 wins given the extra week to the season, given their division. But, you know, the division's been a little better than I thought it would be, so maybe that plays into it. But I truly don't know who to favor in the AFC. I mean, Buffalo has this great point differential, right? They're plus 177, but there are times when they still don't look all that great. I mean, and they are only 10-6. How are you only 10-6 when you're plus 177 in the point differential? Well, I'll tell you how you're that way. Because you beat the Dolphins 35-0 early in the year, you beat the Texans 40-0. So those two games alone, you're plus 75. So when we start to look at how it's gone, they've had a lot of blowout wins, and then of course you've had six losses. And when you look at other than the Jacksonville game, they've lost a lot of the games that they've played against the other top teams. Now, I say that. They lost to the Patriots, a month and a half ago, but then they just beat them a couple of weeks ago. So, I don't know that I look at any of these teams as a favorite. New England's interesting. They have the second-best point differential in the AFC, by the way. Got a great coach, but you got a rookie quarterback. And for a lot of the year, it was like, wow, look at Mac Jones. He's amazing. He's like the young Tom Brady. And then there was a run where he was crappy, and everybody's like, oh, I guess he's not really that good. But then he was pretty good again this weekend. But there's a variable there. I'll tell you, the team that I'm starting to get a little bit interested in is Cincinnati. Like, Joe Burrow is figuring it out. He might be a dude. And I mean, like, dude with a capital D. Have you seen what he's done the last couple of games? I mean, it's pretty ridiculous. I mean, obviously, he and the offense for the Bengals put up 41 against the Ravens in Week 16. In Week 17, just this past weekend, they beat the Chiefs. They put up 34 on the Chiefs. And, when you take a look at his recent run, he's thrown for almost 1,800 yards in his last five games, 12 touchdowns, 2 interceptions. Quarterback rating is 119, and that's when you look at the five-game sample. If you just look at the last two games, almost 1,000 passing yards the last two games for Joe Burrow. He threw for 446 this week against KC. He threw for 525 against Baltimore the week before that. So these last two games, it's pretty ridiculous. But it's almost 1,000 yards with 8 touchdowns and no interceptions. and he's got great weapons, right? I mean, he's got Jamar Chase, he's got T. Higgins, he's got two great wide receivers. They've got a running back who's versatile and talented. I'm beginning to think that they could be a team that makes a run. But I know that any of these team could. That's kind of how I started this premise talking about the AFC. Because they're all in the same boat. I do still think Kansas City can make that Super Bowl run. I think Tennessee can. I don't know why, but I'm a little less sold on them than I should be. I think I'm underestimating them, but I just don't feel as confident about them as anybody else. And then after that, I mean, look, we're still looking at Chargers, Raiders, Steelers, Ravens. All of those teams can still find their way in based on and Colts. All of those teams still have a chance to find their way in into the final two spots in the AFC based on what happens this weekend. On the NFC side, it's just so much clearer. I don't know that it's clear that one of these teams is definitely the best of these teams, but we know who the top teams are, right? I mean, we know Green Bay, Tampa Bay, LA, Dallas. I want to throw Arizona in there, but I can't. I think it's one of those other four that ends up representing the NFC in the Super Bowl. I mean, the Packers are the heavy favorite right now, right? They're the number one seed, which means they're going to get a bye. It means they're going to have the home field after that until you get to the Super Bowl and Lambeau in January. Like, that's where the Packers have a real, you know, we were talking about the Cardinals home and away. I mean, like, the Packers have a massive home field advantage all the time, but it's even more massive when you're playing up there in January. Because they're used to it. Aaron Rodgers has proven that he can play in those conditions. Now, I don't think it's that big of an advantage if you're going up against the Bucs. Typically, you would say, ooh, Southern team going into the cold. Not Tom Brady played in the cold forever. You know, and as Tom Brady goes, so go the Buccaneers. You know, and things aren't looking perfect and rosy for Tampa Bay right now, but you have to count them in based on the construction of the roster. Based on what they did last year and just based on the fact that Brady's the quarterback. And I usually try to find a way to kind of poo-poo what's going on with the Dallas Cowboys because they're always overhyped, right? Anytime they're good, it's always, you know, overhyped. I don't think it is this year. I think they might actually be better than 11-5, and they have the best point differential in the NFC, and the third best in the NFL. They've got two of the top playmakers in the league on defense. Micah Parsons is a beast. Trayvon Diggs, think about this for a second. I actually had to look this up earlier. He has 11 interceptions this year, Trayvon Diggs does. You know the last time a player had 11 or more interceptions in an NFL season? 1981. And it was Everson Wall of the Cowboys, coincidentally. So you've got two guys there that are probably candidates for Defensive Player of the Year. You know you have a diversified offense with weapons all over the place. I actually kind of like that team. I like them for a playoff run. I don't know that I like them more than Green Bay, but I'm pretty confident today saying that Dallas, Green Bay, Tampa Bay, and LA, those are the four teams that are, one of those four will be in the Super Bowl. But I would actually put the Rams further down the list. For whatever reason, I know they've got a 5-game winning streak and all that. Matthew Stafford has not been that impressive here lately. I don't know. There's just something about the way that's looked. And I'm a huge Matt Stafford fan. I mean, I'm a Lions fan. He's the best quarterback that my franchise has ever had. I think he's been vastly undervalued over the years because he's always been on bad teams. But it just hasn't been that great in the second half of the season for him. But they do have the potential. They've got a lot of weapons. I'm not sure I'm buying the McVay genius thing as much as other people are selling it. But for the NFC, though, I don't see anybody else creeping into that mix. Philly made the playoffs. They're not a team that I think is going to make a run. Again, Arizona, I don't want to totally dump on them, but the way it's gone in the second half, after the 8-0 start, I mean, you're 3-5, right? I mean, I'm doing the math there correctly, am I? Right? They're 11-5, so they went 8-0, and then you take the 7, and you. So they're 3-5 in their last 8 games, and they've lost games. I mean, they lost to the Lions, like that. They're just it. There's something there that's just not. And they, you know, they've had that reputation as a team that collapses in December. I will say this, they've made a nice jump this year, and Kyler Murray's very talented, but I don't know that what they did going 8-0 out of the gate to put them in this position where they're already locked in is what they are at the moment. I mean, we're going to find out soon enough. All right, hang tight. I got one more bit to get to on the football side of things, and we'll touch on that next here on KMOX. I just wanted to get in one more quick thing, and I know this is a football, it's a football related topic. It doesn't really stick to football. It's something that we can apply to, you know, talking about different players from different generations across the board. It's really what drew me to this. Some friends of mine were emailing about Ben Roethlisberger. Of course, last night was what will probably be his last game as the Steelers quarterback at Heinz Field. Sounds like he's pushing towards retirement at the end of the regular season. They're still in the playoff hunt, so who knows? It doesn't look like they're going to get a home game there. But the fact is that he's winding it down, right? And had some buddies of mine throw at me, you know, is he the best? You know, who's the better Pittsburgh Steelers quarterback? Is it him or is it Terry Bradshaw? And you know, the problem with making these arguments, right, is the first response we got from somebody was, well, it's got to be Bradshaw. He won 4 Super Bowls. And my reply was, well, you don't grade individual players based on what the team did, even if it is quarterbacks. I mean, it's not the team is what won the Super Bowl, not just the quarterback. And obviously, Roethlisberger won Super Bowls. And then another guy came back and like, look at the numbers, man. Look at Big Ben's numbers. He blows Terry Bradshaw out of the water. Well, okay, sure he does. But you got to look at the era. People didn't throw the football in Bradshaw's era the way that they do now. You know, everything was different. The rules for covering wide receivers were different. You could beat the crap out of them. They weren't as open. Quarterbacks turned the ball over more. I mean, Terry Bradshaw had as many interceptions as touchdowns during his career. But when you go back and look at the other players that played in that time, that wasn't unusual. That was pretty normal to have the 1-to-1 ratio. It's a different game, different rules. It's impossible, really, to have that kind of conversation. And it's the same crap that comes up when people want to do the Jordan versus LeBron. And, well, you know, LeBron couldn't do this. Like, come on, man. They're two completely different eras. It's like, I mean, it really, and we do this in baseball a lot, where you can't compare what life was. I mean, you can't compare the late 1960s to 2021, when the mounds were bigger and the strike zones were bigger and pitchers were throwing 300 innings a year. Like, it's just not the same. So when we evaluate players, we've got to be smart about it. You want to look at statistical categories that are neutralized to account for the era, right? So you're comparing like against like. How much better is somebody than the average player of their time? I mean, that is really the measure of greatness. That's the measure that we have to have. Like, we have all these baseball Hall of Fame conversations, right? And what ends up happening is the comparison is like, well, you know, this pitcher doesn't have 300 wins or 250 wins. Well, nobody's going to have that anymore. They don't pitch enough games. They don't stay deep enough in games. And it's not their fault. The people that run the sport decide those things. It's how players are developed. It's what they're allowed to do. It's, you know, to me, it's one of the biggest mistakes that's being made in Major League Baseball right now. You don't teach players in the minor leagues to go 3 times through the order. They aren't allowed to because they're all on pitch limits. Well, you're at 90. You're done. Why? Yeah, and then they get to the big leagues, and you're like, well, you know, 3rd time through the order. Well, yeah, because you never let them learn how to do it. You've got to practice something to be able to do it. So again, when it gets back to this whole idea of how do we compare one era to another, the truth is you can't do it very well. But the only way to do it at all is to, again, compare like to like. How much better were you than the people that played at the same time you did? Because those are the only people that played under the same circumstances, under the same rules, against the same teams, the same competition. And we, you know, we get into this, you know, the nonsense of, well, this guy's a winner and that guy's a winner. Yeah, you know, teams win. And I'll say that about Tom Brady, too. People who do this, well, Tom Brady's just a winner. Yeah, he is. He also played for the greatest coach maybe in the history of the National Football League. I mean, in the end, you know, look, 20 years from now, Belichick will probably be a bigger name than Vince Lombardi. When we get to a point where the people who watched Lombardi's team play live are no longer with us, the name everybody's going to refer to is Belichick. He's going to be the standard for greatness. I know in many people's eyes he is now, but I mean, like, it's going to be undisputed. Go 20 years down the road, 25 years down the road, when people who saw Lombardi's Packers teams in person, again, are not with us anymore, are not covering teams, they're not on the beat anymore. The greatest of all time, the GOAT coach, is going to be Belichick. I'd make that argument now. Totally different era. He's had to do this with, you know, the salary cap era and constantly changing players in and around his quarterback. Now, he did have the quarterback, but obviously so did the Packers under Lombardi. But, you know, Tom Brady didn't win by himself, and he didn't win by himself in Tampa. Now, he's the driving force behind it. Quarterbacks almost always are, in the modern era anyway. But that conversation in Pittsburgh kind of, I don't know, it struck me funny. Like, you do know that, like, they couldn't have played in more different eras, right? And by the way, when the Steelers were winning Super Bowls, Big Ben wasn't that good. Like, statistically. Like, he wasn't one of the elite quarterbacks in the league. And the first one, he was a caretaker. He was a hand-the-ball-off kind of guy, and we'll throw when we need to. He didn't really bust out as an elite passer until the year after they won their most recent Super Bowl, which was 2008. He didn't bust out till 2009. In 2008, I think he threw 17 touchdowns with 15 picks. So he wasn't the driving force behind that Super Bowl team. That was the defense. Well, and their running game, right? I mean, Steelers in those years, they had that just ridiculous defense and the running game, which is, of course, what they had in Terry Bradshaw's era, too. And I thought about the ridiculousness of it, and, you know, how do you neutralize for that? Well, you compare guys to the generation that they were in, and who stands out more. And, you know, look, you could make a solid argument that Ben Roethlisberger ranks a little bit better in that type of comparison than Bradshaw, but it's not by much. Because again, Roethlisberger's peers are Brady and Manning and all those guys. Where Bradshaw's peers were great names and they won games, but their stats are not a whole lot different than his. It is part of the fun of being a sports fan, right? I mean, we try to figure these things out, and thankfully, you know, with some of the more advanced analytics, we have a better ability to make those comparisons. We have a better ability to look at how you relate to your own era. And that makes all the difference in the world. All right, that's going to wrap it up for Sports Open Line. Obviously, we're going to do this again tomorrow night. My buddy Chris Ranji is going to be joining me tomorrow, Thursday, and Friday. We're going to have some fun. So tune in for that. We got At Your Service coming up on KMOX.